Mr. Cribb, may I also say it's virtually impossible to have followed that most magnificent speech. Indeed, it was. And I am only happy to know that oration is still an art today, as it was in my time. Citizens, I am most honored this evening, I must say, to be in your company, and specifically to be at this table here amongst this most honored gathering. Indeed, I was seated next to Mrs. Oliver, whom you may not know, is a direct descendant of my own cousins, Mr. Peyton and John Randolph. Indeed, she herself was a Randolph, descendant from John. And then Mr. Cribb, you may not know, is indeed a direct descendant of my good friend and neighbor, Mr. Ben Harrison, up there at Barclay Plantation. Both of these most esteemed families here in the east of Virginia. The Jeffersons, of course, were from the west, where I understand the majority of you are from this evening. So I certainly feel quite at home with all of you. And as Mr. Cribb introduced me very much as a man of the people, I am reminded of an anecdote that my father, Colonel Peter Jefferson, was wont oft to tell. Indeed, it was in reference to his own marriage to my mother, Jane Randolph. Now, Jane was the daughter of Captain Isham Randolph, who was indeed the uncle of Peyton Randolph. His father was indeed the brother of Sir John Randolph. Now, Sir John was the only man knighted by the crown here in Virginia. And I remember Father relating that after the marriage ceremony was over, indeed, Sir John Randolph approached my father and inquired of him whether he had any knowledge of the Jefferson coat of arms, for Sir John Randolph desired to quarter it with the Randolph coat of arms, which, as you know, was indeed the customary effort in those days when families of note were to co-join. Well, Father had no knowledge of the Jefferson coat of arms. None had been given to him by his father, Thomas Jefferson the Younger, and more than one had been delivered to my grandfather by my great-grandfather, Thomas Jefferson the First, who came here to settle in the middle part of the 1600s. So Father replied to the negative, "No, Sir John, I'm afraid I do not know of one." Well, Sir John Randolph was taken aback and immediately replied, "Well, Jefferson, I would suggest that you write directly to the College of Heralds and ascertain whether there be a family coat of arms on the rolls." Now, the Randolphs, as you may know, Mrs. Oliver, were very proud of their family coat of arms. They had it there on the coach door and indeed on the front door of their townhouse here. And I know for a fact that they also had it on their privy door out back. So Father, always one to comply, immediately wrote to the College of Heralds, and within several months the answer returned to the negative. No, there was no Jefferson coat of arms on the rolls. Well, this did not bother Father by any means. Indeed, he was one of the first three or four settlers out in western Virginia, considered himself very much a pioneer. But he knew that he would have to be in front of Sir John Randolph at some point. So he decided, indeed, that the answer would be forthcoming. And when he found himself in Sir John's company, he was approached. And Sir John inquired immediately, "Well, Jefferson, have you received word of your family coat of arms?" And my father replied to the affirmative. "Yes, Sir John, I have. And I wish you to know, sir, that our family coat has two, just like everybody else's." So I thank you for your introduction, Mr. Cribb. Citizens, indeed, I am most interested this evening, as I make an introduction to my particular experience here eastwards, being educated at the College of William and Mary in the most formal curriculum, and then practicing law and being seated in the House of Burgesses. I'm most interested in relating that experience to move quickly into your own queries, for I have always believed, as I was taught by Mr. William Small at the college, that the Socratic method of learning is indeed the most beneficial, for that is the one that creates more directly a universal sphere of learning. So many of the masters at the college there will want to lecture directly from their notes. And after a time, the proctors were made busy to indeed maintain discipline and to knock the boys to attention. But Mr. Small believed very much in asking questions of his students, to inquire directly of them and to allow them to inquire of him. And thereby the knowledge being taught and the issue being taught might expand and touch upon various and other subjects. And so I hope that very much in this effort we may attend to a universal knowledge this evening. When I first came to Williamsburg, I had already attended the English schools that were out west. There were two that I attended, one run by the Reverend Mr. William Douglas, in which I learned reading, writing, the common arithmetic, ancient history, modern history, Latin, and the Greek. The Reverend Mr. Douglas, was a Scot, and indeed I found that I learned much of the Latin and the Greek language with a curious Scottish pronunciation, a brogue, if you will. I later attended the school run by the Reverend Mr. James Murray, who was wont to set me aright, and also to teach some French. And there it was that I acquired, at a young age, a great delight not only in the French language, but also in many of the arts that France has become so well known, architecture, and indeed painting and sculpture as well. I went on to the College of William and Mary, enrolled in the School of Natural Philosophy. I had already studied grammar. There was no need to attend there. I was not interested in being seated as a divine, so no interest to enroll in the School of Divinity. And as I was not an Aborigine, I certainly was not to attend the Brafferton School. I enrolled in natural philosophy and was indeed schooled by Mr. William Small. Now, Mr. Small was revered not only for teaching in the Socratic method, but for introducing to all of his students, indeed, an excitement in learning. He excited the imagination. He sparked a natural curiosity. He made everything interesting. Indeed, that nothing can stand alone, for it is related to everything else. And though it might not seem so at the moment, that tomorrow we should find it does, or perhaps down the road at some point, to find everything indeed connects. He introduced all of his students to the works of Sir Francis Bacon, Mr. John Locke, and Sir Isaac Newton, three men I have always considered the foremost minds of the modern world, for they all agree that we are born free in nature, and that that God that gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. Sir Francis Bacon, in all of his essays, indeed accounting for the adaptability of our human nature, that we are able to subdue and alter our natures, indeed to overcome bad habits and bad customs, and to begin good habits and good customs in young years. This we call, as he said, education, which is, in effect, but an early custom. Mr. John Locke, in his essay on human understanding and his essay on government, to account as well that we are capable of adapting to our new experience accordingly with prescribing new laws and evolving new governments, that we are indeed a people who can adapt as well as adopt. And of course, Sir Isaac Newton in his Principia, to account for formulas that might indeed adapt to change, account for change, the insertion of variables, those numbers that we do not know yet, but may insert in order to attend to the future and adaptability. I do believe, after all these years, more than any other, that Mr. Small helped fix the destinies of my life. Practicing law under Mr. George Wythe, I was put in mind of the great value of natural law, for these are the laws that do not contradict. And therefore, any attorney, any legislator, should strive in making laws and practicing law to imitate the laws of nature. For it is the laws amongst men, particularly the letter of the law, that does contradict. Beyond being seated in the legislative house as a burgess, I could put all of this experience together in order to work and to realize that we were becoming very much our own people here in this new Garden of Eden. Not to neglect that law under which we were born and raised, for indeed I have always considered English law, the finest system of law yet created on this planet for the freedom of the individual. But one of its greatest aspects is that it is open for amendment and that it may indeed be perfected. I think here we had the greatest effort to perfect and amend English law for a more universal freedom. I can say indeed that I somewhat disagreed with what Mr. Locke wrote. Well, Mr. Locke, as you know, in his essay on government, wrote that amongst our inalienable rights are life, liberty, and, perhaps the most knowledgeable crowd here in Williamsburg for some time. Though I may cite with pride, the majority always want to answer pursuit of happiness, and I'm overjoyed. But you know well, Mr. Locke wrote property. And that I have always found to be one of the greatest constrictions and obstacles to happiness and freedom. Only those who had it were allowed the vote. Only those who had it were allowed the ultimate happiness. Indeed, in the courts of justice, only those who had property were allowed their defense. So that when I was elected to the highest office here in Virginia, once the revolution had commenced, I sought indeed some way that we might begin to allow for more equal distribution of property so long as it remained an element of the franchise. And so thereby put in the laws to abolish and dissolve primogeniture and entail. Indeed, as well in this element of property, to seek a freedom of religious opinion, that we may dislodge once and for all a political alliance with one church over another and the government. And as well, hopefully, to begin a general diffusion of knowledge here in Virginia, a general system of education, so that the poor as well as the wealthy, the female as well as the male, may have opportunity to attend to an education. An educated citizenry is a safe citizenry. Ignorance is not bliss. And these were my efforts from my very first opportunity in the highest office to make sure that we could indeed have a more enlightened and propertied citizenry so that we might have a greater voice in our government and the manner to which they themselves would desire to be governed. All of these various bills, of course, received great attack and accusation. I myself am the eldest son in a family of 10 children. I myself was baptized in the Church of England, sit on the vestry of St. Anne's Parish out in Albemarle. I myself was able, through the fortunes of my family, to attend to a higher education. I knew well of what I spoke and the interest, indeed, to allow for a more enlightened citizenry. I can only say that after time, my efforts did prove successful, and yet many of those elements that I fought for are still contested, so I hear. And therefore, I think it perhaps expedient that we turn the floor over to you after these somewhat generalities to hear precisely your questions on those issues and any others you care to raise. And if there are any members of the press here present tonight, I will hope that you will not only identify yourselves, but also your papers, so that tomorrow morning we may account whether you have printed the truth or not. Yes, sir. When did I turn over my property, sir? I turned over my property when I attended further to public office. As you may know, the longer I spent in public office, the deeper in debt I became. And I think you will find that to be so amongst many of these so-called founding fathers, sir. And the fact that 56 of us turned over our property when we signed our names to the Declaration of Independence. As Dr. Franklin said at that occasion there, not in July, by the way, but in September, now, gentlemen, most assuredly, if we do not hang separately, we will be hanging all together. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Now that you're
I'm sorry, sir. Is there anything I would like to say? Well, sir, we created a government, hopefully, that would remain in your hands. Vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God. I would say, indeed, as I have often been confronted, that we may be incapable of governing ourselves, and what is needed, therefore, are strong central governments in order to direct a citizen body and as well to control them. That if we are incapable of governing ourselves, then what makes us capable of governing others? No, sir, I think the Almighty has given all of us at birth an idea of good common sense and an attention to know right from wrong, supported by our families, our churches, our institutions of education. And indeed, should we become lax and inattentive to this, then you may be assured that a government will become as wolves.
Yes. Mr. Jefferson, I've always been curious about your epitaph. Why did you choose those particular items and leave out the many others that you're better known for?
Sir, I'm only curious how you're able to get into my private papers to know exactly what I desire as an epitaph. So we're allowing our government into our private papers now, are we? So I can only say that what I should desire as an epitaph are those things of which I am most proud, those gifts that I have been able to give to mankind and hopefully as well to generations yet unborn, with pride amongst all of my gifts, and certainly no public office I ever held do I consider to be remembered by. I consider any public office not to be attended to with ambition, but with honor. They are themselves gifts given to an individual by a public most grateful, and they should be attended to for a short period of time so that new blood, new ideas may be seeded as well. No, sir, I wish to be known for those gifts that I have created for further happiness and freedom here on this planet. Firstly, to be known, indeed, as the author of the Declaration of American Independence. That might as well show as a beacon light to the rest of the world. That I might be known as the author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. Again, to be as a beacon light to the rest of the world, that all of God's creatures may worship him as we choose. And thirdly, to be known as the father of a university, particularly here in Virginia. A university, sir, in reference to a more universal attention to education, not to neglect the fundamentals of an education, but indeed to allow a curriculum to grow as our minds grow. I attended William & Mary, sir, which, as I mentioned earlier, had only four schools. They have the School of Grammar, Divinity, Philosophy, and the Brafferton, which was for the education of the Indians. I desired that it become or have a more universal curriculum. And so I suggested in 1773 that there be a school of law and police, a school of medicine, a school of literature and modern languages. But I'm afraid that the Board of Visitors did not feel they had the money to support those new seats of study. And so those plans had to be halted until I became governor and two seats were instituted there. But within time, I'm afraid the college continued to neglect my interests, and so I took my plans westwards. But by those three things, sir, I wish to be remembered that I had lived and hope that future generations may benefit.
Mr. Jefferson.
Yes.
We've all read your first inaugural address and consider it one of the great works that students should study, even if you haven't mentioned it as one of those great works, along with the Federalist Papers. And in that address, you said, we are all Federalists and we are all Republicans, and I sympathize with that. But I noticed that your toast, you said, we are all Federalists, we are all Democrats. And I wondered if you had changed your position.
Sirs, you may know more correctly, my platform was the Democratic-Republican platform, so you could read that either way that you choose. Sir, I'm happy to hear indeed that you have been attentive to my first inaugural. I happen to carry with me ever a copy. And if ever we are to question indeed precisely what I meant in that document, I should reiterate for all of you here this evening, and excuse me if I reiterate after you may have heard this already within the last 24 hours, though I doubt it. But I should desire to reiterate again to you what I consider to be the 12 principles of government, good government, as well as 12 principles, the same, of good citizenship, attentive citizenship. And they are forthwith. Firstly, equal and exact justice to all men. Secondly, peace with all nations, entangling alliances with none. Thirdly, support of state governments and their rights. But fourthly, preservation of the general government in its whole constitutional vigor. Fifthly, jealous care of the right of election by the people. Sixthly, absolute acquiescence in all decisions of the majority, and that they must continue to protect the rights of the minority. Seventh, a well-disciplined militia in times of peace until regulars are able to relieve them in times of war. Eighthly, supremacy of the civil over the military authority. Ninthly, honest and direct payment of our debts. Tenth, this is why this needs reiteration, citizens. Tenth, encouragement of agriculture and of commerce as its handmaid. 11th, a general diffusion of knowledge at the bar of public reason. 12th, and several here co-joined under the 12th, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of the individual under protection of the habeas corpus with trial by juries impartially selected. By this we stand for a wise and a frugal government, which will refrain men from injuring one another, but which will otherwise leave them free to regulate their own improvements and industry. Those, as I mentioned, I consider the essential principles of government and citizenry. And I should like to take a hand here, and I beg your pardon, sir, for neglecting you. I just wish, as we are on this subject raised by this gentleman here, in particular reference to democracy and republicanism, how many here believe that our effort has been, and my interest has been, to establish in these United States a democracy? If I may see a show of hands. How many believe that my effort has been to establish a republic? Ah, well, complete acquiescence in all decisions by the majority. Indeed, I rarely use the word democracy. I rarely use the word democracy, for I do not believe it is an efficient method of government in this modern world. Certainly in ancient Greece, where the various city-states were settled at such great distances from one another and sparsely settled in that, they could well afford to come together themselves and to argue their concerns, hopefully come to compromise and prescribe new laws amongst themselves by which they could govern themselves. But here in this modern world, where our population grows with such rapidity, and indeed when we continue to settle at great distances, we can hardly expect that we should leave our families or farms or places of business and come together to argue our concerns and govern ourselves. No, The principles of republican government are the most efficient as they were introduced by ancient Rome, and what we would hope for is indeed a democratic republic in that a more universal citizenry may be represented in electing that government. Yes, sir.
Mr. Jefferson, you mentioned earlier that as you were not a candidate for the divine, that you did not study the theology courses, and in founding your university, you stocked the library with books of theology, but you hired no theologians, lest there be interminable quarreling, if I remember the gist of the argument. Yet later on, you went to write a book on the ethics and morals of Jesus Christ, and I'm curious as to what your current thoughts are from your current position.
Sir, indeed, I am often approached by this. I should indeed make statement firstly. Is it not curious that that we are never much concerned how our neighbor conducts their business, how our neighbor may sow their fields, indeed whether our neighbor consumes twice their substance in the taverns? But the moment our neighbor does not attend the church or thereby conform to its dictates, there is an immediate uproar, is there not? Well, I wish to assure... Well, somewhat immediate. Must be that French wine we had this evening. So I wish to assure you firstly that I do carry my communion with my Maker deep within my heart. It is the foundation of my soul, and I consider it a most intimate relation, as intimate as the relation I carried with my dear wife and continue to carry with my family. With all due respect, sir, I do not think that should be of any interest to you than what you believe should be my interest, if you will. However, my teachings of the morals of Jesus of Nazareth are not my own. Indeed, they are but a compilation of all the, hopefully, the exact words known to have been spoken by Jesus of Nazareth. And these, of course, tended to through various translations of the Holy Writ. It was my interest, shared by both Dr. Franklin and Dr. Rush of Philadelphia, that we might attend to various translations of the Bible and to seek out the precise words agreed to have been spoken by Jesus of Nazareth without any human comment or any elaboration, and to look upon them as indeed the essential teachings and morals of Jesus of Nazareth, which I consider the most sublime yet revealed on this planet. I am against all corruption of Christianity, but I am very much in favor, not so much of the words, but perhaps of the life led by Jesus, that it speaks much greater than his words. Yes.
What are your views towards the writings of your very good friend, Mr. Thomas Paine?
Well, sir, of course, Mr. Paine I had heard of before I made his acquaintance. He had not come here until a later time after we found out of his various writings in England, and then once he came here. I can only say, sir, that my comment upon Mr. Paine may be as well expressed in any issue or interest relative to Patrick Henry, that at times they may have gone quite some distance or too far in trying to excite the public and to rouse them with inflammatory comment and pamphleteering. But I defend every right for them to print that, and defend indeed Mr. Paine's certain theories there and interests. I should also say as well that I became very friendly with Mr. Paine, as he was a man of great science and ingenuity. Are you familiar with that as well? And of course, made his acquaintance in France when he later went over there during the time. So that's your interest this evening. And I'm for fair, if you desired me to get into comments upon Mr. Paine in France, then you'd want to hear all the more about John Paul Jones, and I refuse, indeed, to get involved in any character slurs here this evening. Yes, sir.
Mr. Jefferson, since you just reiterated in your 12th principle of good government, freedom of the press, may I know why you suggested to the Democratic Republican governor of Pennsylvania, sub rosa, that he prosecute a Federalist editor for sedition?
So my concern is, indeed, anything that may be printed or may be cited that is unjustified, or that might indeed... Now, I am not to neglect the freedom of speech here, but when comments... But when comments are made malicious against the government, indeed to undermine the government and to rouse the citizenry in an attempt to undermine the government, then it should be attended to by the chief executive and those in office to do so. Next question.
Mr. Jefferson, there are some of us here this evening who have young men just completing their secondary education, some with the Jesuits, some with the Benedictines. Which of the Commonwealth universities would you recommend them to? And, sir, would you be willing to write a letter of recommendation for them?
Ma'am, they are free to choose whichever of the universities here in Virginia they desire to attend, and that, indeed, their attention to learning will be... greatly recognized as it is to anyone who attends either of those universities. I might prefer, indeed, that they might attend the University of Virginia, for as was made mention earlier, we have a greater library full of more books on theology than perhaps here at this university in town. But that's not to neglect this university, for it is my alma mater. But they are free to make their own choices, and I would be happy, indeed, to write letters of recommendation for them, after having met them first. Now, we have time for just one further question, and then I know I must take my leave. Yes, sir?
Would you reflect upon your long relations with John Adams?
Well, sir, may I say that I had heard of Mr. Adams, indeed, through our committees of correspondence, long before I met him in Philadelphia when I went up there to the Second Congress. He was always, indeed, accounted as a man of good character and honor, a great esteem, well-educated, and a man of good common sense as well. We fell into many discourses there in Philadelphia and found we agreed on many, many issues. Indeed, our friendship was fast, and we indeed agreed as well that any difference of opinion or politics should never be one to separate a friendship. For then it is no friendship. I will say, sir, that in the election of 1800, that I observed Mr. Adams to have been ever more influenced by the Federalists, by his position, indeed by the efforts to go to war with France, and thereby became very concerned that he had been led astray. Of course, having been elected then to that office, Mr. Adams, you might say, was, most overcome. He had only spent the 4 years there in office, as well. His young son, Charles, had recently died at that point. He was in great lament over that. He refused to take my hand, as you may know, at the president's house and left before even the inauguration was held. I did make effort to be in communication with him. However, it was all refused. And his dear wife, Abigail, did write me on several occasions. I wrote back, of course, most concerned that he had appointed several Federalist judges on the eve of leaving office. But ever the lady, she ignored my advice, and it was not until a good 12 years later that my grandson, Mr. Coolidge, was able to make further comment or contact with Mr. Adams, and I am most grateful that he did, for we were able then to fall back into communication. And as I hear you talk about many of my letters between Mr. Madison and myself, I would look upon those between Mr. Adams as myself as the most valuable correspondence to be had of our reflections and our experiences during the days of the Revolution. For those were the days, indeed, when we met that we held fast to the principles of what this new nation should be about, and recognized as well that we were but victims of a political schism, and that there could have been any other two men to have been in our shoes, and it might have affected. Suppose, perhaps amongst all our agreements, that the one thing we agreed upon the most was the fact that we had the right to disagree here in this new country. Well, citizens, it has been my pleasure to speak with you this evening, and I extend the invitation of this fair city to your happiness and your welfare, and I wish you to know, regardless of your political opinion as well as religious opinion, that I ever remain your humble and obedient servant, Thomas Jefferson.
Mr. Jefferson, this is a pretty tough crowd, and I think you survived all of the vicissitudes and navigated the shows. I must say, it is refreshing to hear a president of the United States that doesn't have an accent. Listen, Sunday brunch at the Kings Mill Resort begins at 10. For those of you who need transportation, the shuttle will leave at Cascades Restaurant at 9:30 sharp. The buses are waiting for us outside, so we need to make our way in that direction. Good night, Mr. Jefferson, and good night to you all.